happen in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Welcome to the End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. The House Oversight Committee announced its first hearing on the declassification of records related to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy and a possible visit to Dallas. Representative Anna Paulina Luna announced on social media that the Task Force on the Declassification of Federal Secrets will hold its first meeting on the assassination of the former president on March 26th. Luna said, quote, "Several key members of the staff and counsel from the original Warren Commission of 1963 are still alive today. Our task force will interview as many living individuals involved as possible to learn the truth about the assassination of JFK and provide transparency to the American people," end quote. So as we wait for those meetings to take place and hopefully news about the secret files, I wanted to share with our listeners a very interesting interview I came across last week. Along with my hero and mentor, Penn Jones Jr., one of the researchers that first got me mesmerized with the JFK assassination was Josiah Tink Thompson. He was one of the early critics of the Warren Commission, and his 1967 book, 6 Seconds in Dallas, truly changed my life. It was a book that ultimately lit the fire in me that still burns today in the search for the truth in the JFK assassination. I have met Mr. Thompson on several occasions and spoken with him at great lengths about his thoughts on the assassination. His two books, 6 Seconds in Dallas, and then the follow-up to that book, which he released in 2021, titled Last Second in Dallas, are works that all serious researchers must own. A few weeks ago, Josiah sat down with Ross Cohart on the News Nation show called Reality Check. This was a fascinating interview, and I want to share it with our listeners today. In this two-part interview, Josiah Thompson takes a deep dive into his theory on the assassination and breaks down the evidence, including official findings from the Warren Commission, eyewitness accounts, and the Zapruder film. Thompson says he believes the files President Trump is set to release could reveal the entire story. Here's part one of that interview. You don't want to miss this.
Lastly, sir, we have an executive order ordering the declassification of files relating to the assassinations of President John F. Kennedy, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
That's a big one, huh? A lot of people are waiting for this for a long, for years, for decades, and everything will be revealed.
Hello, and welcome to Reality Check. This week, we're bringing you an interview from The Locker with Josiah Tink Thompson. I had the pleasure of meeting Josiah Thompson last year when I was asked by News Nation to reinvestigate the assassination of JFK for the 60th anniversary for November 1963. It is an intriguing mystery, and as a young man when I first studied the Warren Commission, which was the official US government inquiry into the JFK assassination, it always struck me you could drive a truck through the holes in that commission's findings. And that's exactly the conclusion that Josiah Tink Thompson came to. Josiah's got a very interesting background. He's done perhaps the definitive investigation into the JFK assassination. In 1967, he published a book called 6 Seconds in Dallas, a micro-study of the Kennedy assassination. And in early 2021, he published Last Second in Dallas. And they are two definitive tomes on the JFK assassination. And Josiah speaks with some knowledge, particularly of weapons. He's actually somebody who's quite shy about his background, but he worked in the precursors of the Navy SEALs. He was with the UDT, the Underwater Demolition Teams, a special commando unit in the US Navy. And he has an extensive knowledge of weapons, and because of his history as a private investigator, he's also a methodical investigator. Here's Josiah Thompson on the JFK assassination and why you shouldn't believe what the government tells you all the time. Tink, 60 years ago, a president was murdered. JFK was assassinated in Dallas. Officially, the government position through the Warren Commission is it was a sole shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald. Is that official version wrong?
Yes.
Why?
Couldn't have happened that way.
Why do you say that?
Because the evidence in the case will not permit it. Will not permit a single gunman to have done this.
Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty of the evidence, the thing I'm fascinated by is that even LBJ, JFK's successor, didn't believe the single bullet theory, did he?
There is a phone call between President Johnson and Senator Russell, who was on the Warren Commission. And they're old friends from the Senate, and they're talking about the Warren Commission's conclusions. And the single bullet theory, of course, is one of the central conclusions. And they both end up agreeing that it's wrong.
The official version is that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, that there were three shots, one shot missed, one shot, a single bullet, caused seven wounds, and the third shot, from behind JFK, went to his head and killed him. Is that wrong?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's wrong because there were not three shots. There were at least four and very likely five. And Kennedy was hit in the head twice. First, when you see it in the Zapruder film at between 312, 313.
That's frames 312, 313.
Those are frame numbers of the film. The film ran at 18.3 frames per second. So that's very fast. And Kennedy was hit from two directions, from the front first and then from the rear. The first bullet impacted on a tangent to the top of his head from the right front and blew bone, blood, brain matter back and to the left.
And indeed, in the Zapruder film, you do see the president being pushed as if from the right, slumping into the left-hand side of the seat behind him.
You see him, actually, the head leads the movement, and his head and body are thrown by the impact to the left rear. He was sitting in the right corner of the rear seat, and he was thrown in the direction of his wife, also sitting in the back seat.
Now, the thing that fascinates me is the Warren Commission never got to show that film. It was never displayed, the Zapruder film, as part of the Warren Commission evidence, was it?
It was displayed in many pages of volume 18.
As a still photograph?
As a still frame photograph, yes.
Now, did the representation of the Zapruder film in the Warren Commission report accurately represent what you eventually saw on the film in the National Archive?
No. The frames are reproduced two to a page in black and white. There are some 287 or several hundred frames reproduced. Just two of those several hundred frames were, according to J. Edgar Hoover, there was a printing error, and they were reversed. What is clear to anybody is they were reversed. I could show you that. The two frames that were reversed are 314, that's after 313, and 315.
Now, Tink, explain to the audience, what would the reversal of those images lead anyone to conclude?
That there was an immediate forward movement after impact, not a rearward movement, which is what actually happened.
So do you believe that those frames were reversed deliberately to mislead anyone reading the Warren Commission report into the belief that the shot came from behind?
Hoover said it was a printer's error. I'll just leave it at that. You can all make your own judgment.
You're very careful, aren't you? You stick to what you know.
Yeah.
But on its face, there is misleading evidence presented in the Warren Commission report.
Well, not in the report. This is in a volume 18 of its hearing.
So in the summary of evidence that's presented in the appendices of the Warren Commission report, there is a reversal of frames 314 and 315, which would lead anyone looking at those frames to think that the shot came from behind.
I think that's true, yes. Yes. I should point out that nowhere in the report of the Warren Commission is the climax of the Zapruder film ever mentioned. The climax of the film, of course, is when you see in frame 313 the president's head explodes. You're watching, in fact, the killing of John Kennedy in the Zapruder film. And you never see its apex, nor is that apex ever mentioned.
What was that moment like when you saw the film for the first time in the National Archives? What did it tell you?
Well, technically, we were looking for all sorts of things. But the actual film that I saw in the summer of 1966 in the archives was a copy of a copy. So it was not nearly as sharp as the copy I later worked with when I was employed by Life magazine on this case.
When you saw the high-resolution imagery of the Zapruder film, what conclusion did you come to when you saw those key frames showing the moment when the president's head was hit?
Well, let me answer that in a funny way. Let me say that I felt the same thing Don DeLillo felt when he saw the Zapruder film over and over again in preparing his film Libra. Every drop of my blood, he says, every drop made me feel that the shot came from the front.
You believe it wasn't just Lee Harvey Oswald at all?
No, I don't know. One shot was fired from the sixth floor corner window to Kennedy's head, but that's not the shot at 313.
So what you're suggesting is that quite literally, whoever did kill Kennedy was on the grassy knoll.
That's right.
And that couldn't have been Lee Harvey Oswald.
No, because he was never, ever near the knoll that day.
What's the evidence that you believe is the most convincing piece of evidence to suggest that the kill shot came from the grassy knoll?
It's a combination of what we see in the Zapruder film, which is Kennedy's head leading. He's thrown instantaneously backwards and to the left. His elbow comes up and he bounces off the seat. That's compelling. The compelling evidence for this is right there in the Zapruder film and always has been.
It's completely inconsistent with a shot from behind. I think there's something called the jet effect, isn't there? People have tried to suggest that the way that Kennedy's body reacted might have been due to some kind of reverse force from the impact from behind.
Right.
Do you think there's any validity to that theory?
No. No, that's not worth discussing. It's just not true. The supporting evidence for this is, ask the obvious question. If Kennedy's hit in the head, where does the impact debris from that go? Because, you know, have you ever seen, you see Quentin Tarantino has done this several times in making his movies. A guy's in a room or something, and he gets shot in the head. What happens? Well, what happens is that the bullet goes through and draws with it a whole mess of gore, which then slops up against a wall and then begins to drip down on the wall. Well, in this case, there's no wall, but there is, in fact, what Tarantino depicted, and the impact debris, we do know where it went.
So let's go through that. The two outriding motorcyclists on the far side from the grassy knoll, one of them in particular was hit by a piece of what was eventually discovered to be JFK's skull. Now, is there any way that a shot from the book depository, which was behind the presidential limousine, could have been in any way the cause of that spray?
No, a shot to the back of Kennedy's head, blowing out the front, would have thrown impact debris over the limousine.
And it didn't?
Well, a second shot was fired from the depository and did just that.
But the primary shot that, by all accounts, destroyed the back of the president's head.
Well, killed him.
Yes.
Certainly, the 313 shot killed John Kennedy.
That debris was sprayed as if the shot came from the grassy knoll.
Yes. Yes. Let's take the first nearest motorcyclist, riding the inboard cycle off the left rear of the limousine. His name is Bobby Hargis. And Bobby Hargis told a reporter on November 23rd that he thought he'd been hit by a bullet. he was hit so hard in the midsection by this impact debris, which was on his helmet and et cetera, that he thought he'd been hit. Only immediately he stopped his cycle. They were only going 8 miles an hour at this time. He stopped his cycle, put the kickstand down, pulled out his gun and ran across the street up towards the knoll. He was asked then later at his deposition why he did this. He said first he thought the shot was fired from close in. Well, actually, it was shot from about 100 feet away, so it was close in.
He believed the shot came from the knoll.
He did, and he stumbles around trying to express this during his deposition to the lawyer. But what he says is, yeah, I mean, I could give you the quote, but I can't remember the full quote, but that's exactly what he says. The reason I ran up there was because I thought the shot came from up there, basically.
Now, he wasn't the only one, was he? There were multiple witnesses, dozens of witnesses, who believed the shots came from the grassy knoll, as well as the book depository.
Let's just talk about witnesses who... The last two witnesses, as you go down Elm Street during the shooting, the witnesses that are available there thin out. And the last two witnesses on that north side of the street are first Bill Newman and the Newman family.
Now, Bill's the guy who jumps on top of his son. He's actually lying on top of his little boy.
Yeah, after the next to last shot is fired, they are erect, standing on the sidewalk beside the...
Now, what did Bill say about where he thought the shot came from?
He said he thought it came from the little garden up above.
The grassy knoll.
Up above, which is part of the grassy knoll.
Now, I want to take you through this because this is quite important evidence. There's also a woman called Cheryl McKinnon. What did she say she saw?
She thought it came from the knoll also, but she's further back, further up.
But didn't she also say she thought she saw puffs of smoke still hanging in the air?
Well, that was also seen by some eight witnesses on the overpass. And the House Select Committee took that all up and asked an expert about this. Does smokeless powder give off any smoke? And the smokeless powder expert had to say, well, under certain circumstances, yeah. There was kind of filtered light along the stockade fence on the knoll, and that light filtered by trees there would have produced a good environment to see smoke.
Now, you said that the shot that the motorcycle outrider felt the impact of debris from probably came from about 100 feet. As I understand it, the grassy knoll position where you believe the shooter, or at least one of the shooters, was located is 95 feet from the president's car.
That's correct.
So you're pretty spot on there.
Yeah.
There are other people. There's a guy called Skinny Holland who was on the overpass. What did Skinny Holland say he saw?
Oh, Skinny Holland is something. Skinny Holland... It's not just what Skinny Holland said he saw.
Let's just tell me exactly what the evidence was that he gave, though. What did he give evidence about?
I wish I could use photographs to do this. Skinny Holland said that he was certain that the next to last shot came not from the depository. The first three shots came from up Elm Street, and he wasn't precise about where up Elm Street they were. But the next to last shot, that is the fourth shot, came from behind the fence on the knoll.
And he also saw smoke, I understand.
And he also saw smoke, as did seven other people who later told stories of having seen smoke from the overpass.
There's also the evidence of Clint Hill, the Secret Service agent, which suggests that there were different sounds from different shots, suggesting different rifles.
Yes. Both Holland and Clint Hill say that the next to last shot, the fourth shot, had a different sound. Holland told me it was like the difference between a shotgun and a .38 revolver.
There's also the fact that a woman called Mary Mormon took a key photograph.
Right.
Tell me about the Mary Mormon photograph.
Well, the importance of the Mormon photograph is that it was taken at Zapruder frame 315, that is 2/18ths of a second after Kennedy was hit in the head. Even back then, I knew the importance of it was because it shows the knoll. And at a certain place in that photograph, one can see what I've always called an anomalous shape, which is about the size of a human head, and it's about 8 to 12 feet from the corner of the fence.
And that corresponds with exactly where Skinny Holland says he saw the puff of smoke.
Well, here's how... Skinny Holland, the importance of Skinny Holland is that he didn't just tell people about this, he did something about it. As soon as the shooting was over, Holland took off to his left, and they climbed over a steam pipe. Holland and three other railroad workers did this. They climbed over a steam pipe and made their way into the mess of cars in the parking lot. They got to the corner of the fence, and about 8 to 12 feet west of the corner, they found a bunch of footprints in the mud. It had rained the night before and stopped raining around 9:15, 9:30 that morning, so the earth was wet. And they also found cigarette butts there. Well, I wanted, at that time, when we had interviewed for Life magazine, we interviewed Holland for about 4 hours one night. And then we asked him if we could meet him at Dealey Plaza so he could show us what he did that day and what he saw that day. And he did the following Saturday. Now, I knew of the importance of the Mormon photograph, so I asked Skinny Holland to stand behind the fence at the exact spot where he discovered these footprints, and et cetera, et cetera, and where another witness, Bowers, in the railroad tower, also saw a couple of strangers before the shooting, a very important area. So he did so, and I went to Mormon's position and took a picture. Right, so we now have a picture of where Holland was standing when he did that, and that's important. That's right where this shape appears in the photograph.
Was any of this evidence that you're talking about taken into consideration by the Warren Commission?
No.
Or the House Select Committee on Assassinations?
No.
Do you believe it was deliberately covered up?
I don't know. I mean, all these questions that involve the intention of people. This evidence has been around since I wrote 6 Seconds was published in 1967. Nobody's laid a glove on it.
You've worked on this case pretty much since the assassination, haven't you?
Yeah, well, off and on.
60 years. Mm. Where are you at now? Do you believe still that the JFK assassination, on the evidence, was a conspiracy involving multiple shooters?
I would prefer, well, of course, but what I'd rather say is, now we know, for all these years, up until the last 15 years, when I learned about the recent discovered evidence, I always saw the picture as unclear, as not coming into right focus. And it's only in the last 15 years that I can see that picture as having clarified itself. And what it clarifies itself into is not the picture of some unknown gunman who goes out there to kill the president with his buddies, but a professional hit.
It was a conspiracy.
This was, not only a conspiracy, but a professional hit by people who are very adept at killing people.
Next week on The End of Innocence, the JFK assassination, you'll hear part two of Josiah Thompson's interview. You will hear what Thompson thinks happened that day, the series of events, and his thoughts on a possible cover-up. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you, you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.